Once upon a time, a glorious World Trade Center stood tall and strong, the center of Manhattan. But after September 11th, 2001,
American life completely changed.
Fast forward to the present. We live in a world where police use sonic weapons and tasers on unarmed citizens during public assembly. Federal prisoners might be allowed counsel for a trial, and warrantless wiretaps apply to the average U.S. citizen.
Hello!
And when you opened your eyes today, you just might have been waking up Orwell. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily the views and opinions of the sponsors of Waking Up Orwell.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Waking Up Orwell, where there is certainly cause for optimism. Because I know I can depend on you to stand up for your own personal liberty. Because the probability of you being an apathetic sack of cynical entropy is nil if you listen to this program. If you are one of those people who are entertained by turning on all the lights in a dark room and watching the cockroaches stop and then flee, good, I know I can trust you. I know you'll be the exact same people who will turn right around, call pest control, rather than living in subhuman conditions. Good for you. You have standards. Thanks for tuning in. It's better to be informed and to have rights. So be a proud nerd. Take courage because you actually do not have to suck it up. That is the truth. There's a lot of bad news out there, but the best news of all is that we caught it, and there's something you can do about it. We only have one guest, travel shaman expert, Sir Edward Hasbrook of San Francisco Bay, care of the Identity Project. He's going to tell us the annual truth about the status of your travel rights in the United States going forward. Look for links to the papersplease.org travel guide under the do-it-yourself government heading. And indeed, this is the most intensive do-it-yourself government show probably ever, because the evil white wizards posing as elected officials and Congress are busy yelling, "You shall not pass," over all the wrong stuff. And they're giving the green light to things like the S-1867, the National Defense Authorization Act, or the Annual Military Defense Authorization Bill. So what's wrong with this bill? In case you haven't heard, under the hood of terrorism prevention, it would empower the U.S. military to arrest fellow citizens without cause or a warrant, and then throw them into a military detention facility indefinitely without a trial. I'm going to take you back to a historic regression, to the genesis of America. There was a document created, an addendum to the United States Constitution called the Bill of Rights. You may have heard of it, which includes this arcane ancient legal script, which reads, here's this Fourth Amendment script. It says, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated," "and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized." So I'm going to go over here to the Sixth Amendment. It says, "In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense." I'm no lawyer, and I didn't go to law school, but it's pretty clear to me that that probably wouldn't stand up in any court. This law, if Obama signs his name on it, would basically be passing a unconstitutional piece of legislation, wherein I don't think anyone, including the United States military, is beholden to by oath, because their oath is to the Constitution and to the U.S. people, not to a flaky criminal bot government, which forgot the whole point of being an American. So if Obama signs this, he'll be signing an unconstitutional, clearly unconstitutional piece of law. And he's made noises that sound exactly like, I will veto this if this amendment is not dealt with. Whatever his reasons are, I'll take it. I'll take the veto. You know, I know it's political, but I don't really care. If they manage to pass this bill, we reserve the right to refuse to be detained. And the military doing this refused the right to enforce this law because it's unconstitutional. It's clearly, blatantly unconstitutional. So, congratulations, you'll have made an unenforceable law. A law that's probably indefensible by Department of Justice standards. At this point, I'd like to just pat or give approbation to the Congress leaders who decided to vote on the side of the Constitution and on the side of their own freedom. You know who you are. You know, you're not, your names are not being celebrated probably like they should be. I know when it came time to put up or shut up, Washington State, through the first round of voting, definitely said no to keeping this section in there. In the lightning round of votes, only 7 golden folks decided that they were going to vote on the side of the Constitution. Only 7 senators out of our entire congressional reserves. You know, these are people who are kind of voting against us. They're voting against the Constitution. And they don't really have the right to do that. They're representing us. Congress also takes an oath to the Constitution first. So, as lawmakers, they're perverting justice by voting on a bill that should have been vetted as a constitutional or anti-constitutional document. You know, I gotta hand it off to Rand Paul, because he stood up there and gave his speeches, plural, about this bill, and I believe the American people are behind him. But he may be the only lone voice yodeling from the peak of the Capitol Hill, which is a shame. But that's okay. Do-it-yourself government is about speaking up for yourself, American. These people can't lead. They've lost their credential. Washington has gone bat. So, get up, stand up, stand up for your rights. You have them. And before you completely lose them, get up, stand up for your rights. You still have them. You know, I know I'm being simplistic here, but here's what I think. If everybody's taking these constitutional oaths, I mean, all of them took it. Even the most liberal, and the most conservative, they all took oaths to the Constitution. They know what it says. They know how it reads. They all got the same piece of paper. But Carl Levin seems to think that the Constitution doesn't apply anymore. And that's why he's able to craft a bill like this? What if every senator who voted on a bill like this, or voted in favor of a bill like this, or crafted a bill like this, were to be basically simultaneously impeached? Or at least the document would be impeached because it's an unconstitutional act. I mean, maybe that would stop. Maybe that would help. You know, and of course there's going to be a flurry of people who can't tell me why that can't happen, but I don't actually care. You know, there's got to be a moment of sobriety here. Okay, if someone presents the U.S. Congress with a clearly bald-faced, unconstitutional bill, who's in the wrong? I swear to God, it's not me. There was a time in American history where somebody, they might get locked up for something called treason, or be called a traitor. And that has been said, that the people who voted in favor of this bill have been traitors to the American people, to the U.S. Constitution. I mean, these are basic things. You're not wrong. You're sane. This is an unconstitutional piece of legislation. You're not wrong. Everybody sees what's going on, and they know it's wrong. Which is why do-it-yourself government is so much more important than normal. Okay, if you're a military serviceman, thank you for standing up for our country. Thank you for agreeing with your entire body and life to defend this country. But they are railing the Constitution where you're going to be forced to do things that are in direct conflict with that Constitution. If this bill passes, God bless you. God bless your service. God bless your soldiers who have died next to you and with you in combat. You know, regardless of what kind of soldier commission or orders that you've been given, you know, you're still beholden to that Constitution. And that's what you're sworn and to defend. We deserve better. Honestly, we really deserve better. We deserve better than a bottomed-out economy without real money. We deserve better than being surveilled. We deserve better than this crappy cybersecurity piece of legislation. I got a note here about that from one Julian Sanchez, who's I've recently become quite a good fan of. He writes for Tech Liberation Front and for the Cato Institute. He's a really cool guy, and he's working on this. And I see him going, hey, 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 pay attention, and here's why. I'm going to read it to you. Not a lot of people are really talking about the cybersecurity bill right now because there's so much going on. I think we're getting broadsided by a bunch of especially crafted legislation that really challenges basic liberties. So this is what it says. It says, I wrote on Monday that a cybersecurity bill overwhelmingly approved by the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence risks creating a significantly broader loophole in federal electronic surveillance law than it boosters expect or intend, creating both legal leeway and a trusted environment for limited information sharing about cybersecurity threats, such as the identifying signatures of malware or automated attack patterns, is a good idea. Yet the wording of the proposed statute permits broad collection and disclosure of any information that would be relevant to protecting against cyber threats. So it's another dragnet. And thus broadly defined. For now, that mostly means monitoring the behavior of software. In the near future, it could easily mean monitoring the behavior of people. So it's another data surveillance bill any way you slice it. And data surveillance is a really big problem. So I'm going to post the rest of this article under the link section. It's time to talk about the Dragnet's Dragnet, which has gotten exactly zero coverage almost. This would be the Advise DHS program of 06, covered by one Christian Science Monitor. So I'm going to read you the wiki entry instead. We love Wikipedia. They save our life. Give them money. Okay, so this is Advise, A-D-V-I-S-E, and it's called Analysis Dissemination Visualization, Insight, and Semantic Enhancement. So what it means is it's a research and development program within the United States Department of Homeland Security, threat and vulnerability testing and assessment portfolio. It is reported to be developing a massive data mining system, which would collect, analyze data on everyone in the United States and perform a threat analysis on them. The data can be everything from financial records, phone records, emails, blog entries, website searches, and any other electronic information that can be put into a computer system. The information is then analyzed and used to monitor social threats such as community forming, terrorism, political organizing, or crime. Advise will possess the ability to store 1 quadrillion data entities. The exact scope and degree of completion of the program is unclear. Advise is in the 2004-2006 federal DHS budget as a component of the $47 million TVTA program. The program was officially scrapped in September of 2007 after the agency's internal inspector general found that the pilot testing of the system had been performed using data on real people without required privacy safeguards in place. I think ADVISE has been scrapped in word. It has not been scrapped in deed. So we're poking around to find out whether or not there's another form or version of ADVISE that's been resurrected, re-scrambled, and renamed in context of surveilling community forming, political organizing, and crime, because that certainly sounds like something that the FBI has been doing a lot of lately, especially with use of the local police systems and something called the suspicious activity reporting, and very similar stuff, so that anything and everyone anywhere is a suspect of suspected terrorism, so that everyone gets a file. And we forgot about this ADVISE program. It was supposed to be scrapped, but it keeps coming out in other ways. So maybe we can get to the bottom of it. I'll keep you posted on what I find. I'm going to change gears just a tiny bit. I read a post on the Huffington Post regarding the integration of Canada and the United States at the borders. And there was a big border pact deal, which had a lot to do with trade and information sharing and that sort of thing. We talked about it a lot on the last program. In fact, we had Dave Weingarten on from Fortress Toronto to discuss, well, what do you know? They're going to try to trade all of our information from this big data dragnet, which is supposed to not exist, but does. they're gonna try to share it with Canada. And amazingly enough, this never got reported in America, basically, with the exception of yours truly. I was probably the lone soldier in the news field who decided that they were going to care about it, because I've been told in jest by those who know better that this is boring news. Yeah, well, you know, boring as in like, oh, boring old Canada. They're only going to get all of our deep dish information that's been scraped up by national security robots here in the U.S. But who cares about that? It's just Canada, right? Wrong. So a few people that are very good at this advocacy stuff have figured out a neat little strategy, and we're going to go into it with Ed Hasbrook. He also has some good information about why these things happen. And what goes on when it becomes foreign policy? When your domestic information suddenly becomes foreign policy information. And, you know, that has a lot to do with travel and where that data goes. So we're going to get to that in a few minutes, but first I have to dump on Huffington Post. Huffington Post is, you know, by and large a good publication, but they are now owned by AOL. They're under the rubric of Murdochian janking. Which means that they can put in 99.5% truth, and then the little 2% poison they dump in there will turn and steer the rudder of the rest of the article. So I saw a really good cause-related piece in Huffington Post featuring a half-quote from Jennifer Stoddart of Canada, but it seemed like it was a section of the quote that was misleading to me, that Canadian citizens would choose trade over privacy and security issues. And I think that that is misleading, because I had access to a poll at that point that came from a Canadian publication online that said that there was a 68% vote that was very concerned about the integration of that data information, because it's personal. Like, for them, they have better privacy standards and data standards than we do. It would be a step down for them to have to be forced to share their information with us. So, you know, they're not as data raped as we are. I hate to say it, but it's the truth. And so for that, I had to say something, because what it sounded to me like was that they were going to not acknowledge, or there were riots in Toronto or in other places in Canada when Prime Minister Harper decided to forego public input, close it down, and kind of take the grievances of the Canadian people and cast them aside. I'll have you know that no one in America was given such an option. I don't think they even were kind of aware enough to protest. Because this stuff is suppressed. Data surveillance is more or less suppressed. And anyone who wants news about this stuff has to, you know, dive in online and really dig for it. So, but the people who know and really know. That's the good news. On the upside, I appreciate Huffington Post finally deciding to report the news on the day of the Harper-Obama meeting in Washington on Wednesday. You know, congratulations, thanks for doing your job. But you could do it a little bit better next time by reporting actual dissent, the fact that there's news suppression in America on this. With that, that's a good segue and a good transition to our interview. We are speaking with a consultant for human rights and civil liberty and travel relations for the Identity Project. This would be one Ed Hasbrook, and you can watch his work on papersplease.org. Ed, welcome back to the program.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Sheila. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, great. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what's going on with this bilateral agreement, but before we go there, there's been a lot of activity, a lot of increase in John Pistole's area of concern. Today, I think there's Trusted Traveler, there's PNR data, which is passenger name recognition data, there's the automated targeting system, and these are pan-American, and they extend across the seas to a global formation where we're exchanging our personal data with other countries, and other countries are in a position to be made to exchange that data with us. But anything else outside of that is kind of murky. The details aren't real clear. So I would like to talk to you more about those things, and definitely in context of what can be done and what people definitely should be aware of going into the holiday season. So if you don't mind, let's start there. So let's just pretend like I'm a big dummy and I have never heard of anything called PNR or ATS. What would you tell the average person about their personal records and privacy when they fly?
Well, there is a group of systems which go by a number of different names. The automated targeting system, secure flight, but together what they make up is a system of surveillance and control of travelers based on the information about you that's contained in airline reservations. And so what people need to know is that two things happen when you fly. The first thing is that the U.S. government has route access to the airline reservations. So if you ask for a kosher meal, you ask for a halal meal, you ask for one bed or two in your hotel room if it's reserved by the same travel agency as your flights, all this is available in real time to the U.S. government with very little control and not even any logs kept as to who has accessed it or where else it has gone. And this is kept not merely if you're on a watch list or you're a suspect, and even if nothing seems to happen, those traces are left behind. DHS is copying a mirror image of all of the international airline reservations into its own database and keeping them. So if you've flown internationally in the last 10 years to or from the U.S., the Department of Homeland Security has a file on you containing all of your airline reservations for that period and perhaps further back. We don't know exactly when they started this because, in violation of the Privacy Act, they didn't give prior notice that they were setting up this system.
So why don't they just get rid of it? If it's in such gross violation, why wouldn't they just get rid of it? Why isn't there that kind of a move?
Well, there are two ways that could happen, but both of them would require other federal agencies to take action against the Department of Homeland Security, and those other agencies aren't interested in doing that. Federal prosecutors could have brought criminal charges against the DHS officials. This clearly violated the criminal provisions of the Privacy Act, but in their exercise of prosecutorial discretion, U.S. attorneys have chosen, strangely enough, not to indict their comrades from the DHS for keeping illegal files on people, which is, after all, what the Privacy Act was originally supposed to be enacted to prevent. The other way that there could be oversight would be if Congress were to take action to defund this. And sadly, although a few members of Congress expressed concern when the system first was made public years after it was in operation, none of them have actually chosen to press to get funding for the automated targeting system cut off, much less to legislatively mandate that the system be disbanded. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, the Privacy Act doesn't really leave us any way to directly challenge that as individuals. I'm the plaintiff in a test case under the Privacy Act in which I'm seeking to find out what's actually in the dossier about me, what are the threat scores that I've been given, how were those assigned, who else has gotten my data. But that will just get information that even if I'm successful in the lawsuit, that will not shut down the system.
So that's important information, Ed. My thought here is that most people don't know that they're being tracked this way or surveilled this way. What would you recommend if someone suddenly became interested, like, I want to know. I want to know what they know about me. What would you do?
Well, unfortunately, DHS has exempted the entire system from the Privacy Act. Again, I'm fighting in court because I made my request several years before they published the exemption rules. So there's no guarantee that you can find out anything of what's in their file about you, but most people have received some censored excerpts, which are still quite interesting and useful. So one of the first things, once you realize they have a file about me, is they are going to use that file, whether you know what's in it or not. I mean, I've had, even crossing the border at a land border, I've been questioned about things that were in my airline reservations on previous international trips. So it behooves you to find out what's in your file. If you go to papersplease.org, we have forms there for people to request their own records, and as I say, it'll be censored, and
they mean redacted.
Well, they claim they don't have to provide everything, but you'll probably get something, and most people have found that quite useful. So, you know, ask for your files, find out. The other, you know, piece of this, though, to be aware of is there's a surveillance component, but it's also a control component. That on the basis of this information from your reservations, they will make a decision as to whether or not to let you on the plane, whether or not to require the airline to put you through secondary screening, whether to send a marshal to sit next to you, whether to ask, you know, tell them to ask you some more questions before they let you on, all of these things. I mean, this is related to the secret threat score that you're assigned, the threat assessment and the threat assessment algorithms, which is part of what I'm trying to get. They've admitted they're doing this, but nobody has ever seen their score. Nobody's ever seen the algorithms for assigning these scores. So the key thing here, I think, for people to realize, once again, is that even if nothing seems to have happened, something has happened. You know, the airline cannot let you on the plane until they've sent your reservations off to the government and waited to get permission. And the default is now no. And what's happening now, this started with international flights to and from the U.S. I think because there was a feeling that, well, Americans don't travel abroad, so this is foreigners who are on international flights. Those of us who want to actually see the rest of the world must be subversive, right? Why would you actually want to leave the U.S.? I think the feeling was that they could get away with it with foreigners, that there's this border exception to the Constitution and to human rights. Now, human rights law actually doesn't create any exceptions for borders. That's the whole idea of it being global and human rights. But there was a feeling that they could do this first, you know, with flights that crossed the border. And what we're seeing now is the expansion of this system of, in both inward and outward. inward, and the same system is now being applied to domestic flights. That's the secure flight system, which is being integrated with the system for international flights that was already in operation. So they now need to give information about you to the government and get permission even to let you on a flight from Chicago to Dallas. And it's also being expanded outward in the other direction, and this is where some of the recent events have occurred, where the U.S. is trying to get other countries to open up information about flights even that don't come to the U.S., and give the U.S. the ability to see and to control who gets on any airline flight, anywhere.
I'm sorry, that's shocking. That's just out of control. I mean, it's just... I can't. I don't even have any words for that, to be honest.
And we've seen, I mean, to give you in case you don't believe that and want to know, where's the evidence of this? In addition to the programs, you know, involving the European Union and involving Canada that have been talked about for data sharing and so forth, we've seen evidence in a number of other areas. A German member of the Bundestag, the German parliament, using their equivalent of the Freedom of Information Act, uncovered the fact that there are 75 Homeland Security people sitting in the airport in Frankfurt looking at airline reservations and making recommendations to German authorities as to who to let on flights to and from Frankfurt. And, of course, these are just advisors. They're not making any decisions. This is like U.S. military advisors in Vietnam. You know, so the Germans are taking their word and saying, well, German authorities are making the decisions of who gets on those flights. But they're making the decisions based on recommendations from the Americans, where what's the reason for those recommendations that someone not be allowed to fly? The Germans don't even know, but they're still enforcing those American recommendations, which is a really shocking violation of sovereignty. And I of Germany, I met people when I was in Germany last month who'd been denied boarding on flights from Germany because of these American recommendations, who are still trying to find out why and have no idea. The Germans don't know. You know, in another part of the world, the cables released by WikiLeaks showed information about U.S. efforts to get the Pakistani government to allow the U.S. to control...
Sheila Dean here for Waking Up Orwell. I apologize for the following interruption. There is, in fact, an important explanation for it. So we seem to be developing a pattern here when it comes to time to interview a guest for this show. Twice in a row, Ed's conversation was snapped off, and the call was dropped when he or I uttered the phrase, Pakistan Control. If you are a regular listener, you will find this little show has been plagued with many of these types of interruptions in the past. Proof positive that the message we are sending is something national security robots find offensive. Around this time last year, Ed and I were part of local efforts to resist the use of invasive and carcinogenic Rapiscan x-ray machines employed at San Francisco International Airport. One of the things that went unsaid at press time during opt-out day as legal protest events ensued was that if you were found to be a participant in these protests, your name would be added to a list by the TSA. Automated targeting systems currently employed by the TSA are part and parcel of one such list-making. These lists are created to inflict an arbitrary penalty on flyers. I said in an interview with Cron 4 News that this was designed to have a chilling effect on protest gathering. This information never made it out onto the 14 seconds of coverage featured on the 5 p.m. newscast. The repeated attempts by what may in fact be an echelon system, or the disruptive technology offices in coordination with ongoing development for total information awareness, to stop this program are duly noted. What is most important to the non-government employees who listen to this program is that I have rights. I have a right to not be harassed or profiled in this manner because I'm a United States citizen. If this were happening to someone I knew, I would pick up the phone or write my congressman or tell someone working at a civil liberty firm that the freedom of speech has been imperiled once again. This time, it's my freedom of speech. So if you're within the range of my voice, may you be so compelled to make this webcast as viral as possible so that people will know what happens to independent journalists in the United States. I report the news they don't, they won't, or can't because they are getting an AOL, Gannett, or Wall Street paycheck. Sending this to as many of your friends, colleagues, law firms, listservs, news portals, congressmen, city hall leaders, parents, relatives, acquaintances will protect freedom of speech. That way, liberty will prevail. Thank you. Please stay with us. Ed Hasbrook will be rejoining me from what is an alternate phone connection. I apologize for the audio quality in advance, but I'm working in third world suppressive conditions here.
So, in another part of the world, the cables released by WikiLeaks show that the U.S. was having discussions with the Pakistani government over giving the U.S. access to information about everybody flying between Pakistan and other parts of the world, and the ability to control who was allowed and who was not allowed to fly. So we're seeing the U.S. seeking quite explicitly the role of the world's travel police and the world's travel permission granter and permission denier, not just in the U.S., but around the world. And that is, Sheila, you're right to be shocked. That's quite as outrageous as it seems.
It's jamming my computer programming. I can't really think about that right now. So I want to talk about the bad touching that happens at the airports, because that's still happening to a lot of people. Is that just still international, or has that moved over to domestic flights? Do you know if there's any changes or updates that you feel are relevant?
Well, we're still in a place where there are no rules, fundamentally. You know, there's no law that sets the standard of what is allowed in the context of a suspicionless, warrantless search or interrogation at the airport, either domestically or internationally. So whatever changes there may be are changes in the secret marching orders that we can't see. So this is part of the problem in many of these areas, is that we haven't had a real debate. Congress is not, can't say, this is what the law says and this is what we'd like the laws to say, because there is no law. They've never put forward regulations that we can comment on. And honestly, Congress really hasn't ever debated the establishment of articulated standards for what they're allowed to do. So we're left sort of guessing and looking at anecdotal reports of what happens to individual people at the airport and trying to figure out whether that means that maybe the goons have been given some slightly different instructions. But it's all reverse engineering from outside the black box.
I mean, this stuff is so hardcore to me. I don't recognize my country anymore. That, you know, when Glenn Beck says, you know, this is not the America I grew up in, I might have been the other person saying that as well, who wasn't hired by Fox News, somewhere along the lines. And, you know, let's go to the bad touching. Has it extended to domestic flights? Can we revisit that?
Well, we're certainly, you know, we're hearing reports, you know, routinely from people who are still getting groped, you know, here, there, and everywhere, and certainly that includes domestic flights. I mean, there's other stuff that goes on in terms of, you know, interrogation at international flights, but in terms of how thoroughly do they feel you up, I don't get any sense that the TSA is any different whether you're flying within the country or abroad. And in some ways, it seems like, you know, the TSA at some of the smaller domestic airports may be worse. But it's really, the TSA is out of control. We all know that the TSA is out of control. It's the cutting edge of the contact of the war on terrorism, where the war on terrorism lays hands literally on the bodies of ordinary Americans. So it is, as it should be, the focus of people's outrage. Although, you know, a lot of what I do and what PapersPlease.org does is try to help people become aware and become outraged at the ways that, you know, their data is being raped and things are being done to them that are just as outrageous, but that they don't even see because they don't involve laying hands on you the way it is when the TSA goons do it.
Okay, let me ask you about the list, because I heard a very important statement from Lily Coney at Epic, where she went into detail that this information is all part of what would have been called Total Information Act, but it's literally been renamed the Terrorism Information Project. And that really reframes everything in context of the new surveillance state and the normalization of all this stuff. If that's true, and I presume if Lily Coney is saying it, yeah, it's probably true. When people go forward and they're being analyzed in this manner in terms of travel, what's the pathway that people are using, the conventions that they're using to respond to the state?
Well, in terms of people's, you know, response, I think there's a very good articulation of that just yesterday in a joint statement that was released by the ACLU, Privacy International, and the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. It's in the context of attempting to suggest ideas that should be incorporated in the secret negotiations that are going on between the U.S. and Canada over securing the border and surveilling the citizens and controlling who can cross what used to be, you know, one of the world's most open borders. But I think that those principles are more broadly applicable. And what I was most pleased to see in that joint statement from these civil liberties groups is that this is not being framed simply as a question of privacy, which it is, but it's more than that. When people are saying, no, you can't step across that line, you can't get on that plane, that's more than an issue of privacy. You know, that's about very fundamental rights and interference with, you know, freedom of movement, which is essential to so much else, to assembly, to organizing, to the ability to resist. So that joint statement said that this debate needs to be framed and that proposals for these kinds of policies need to be evaluated in terms of, among other things, international human rights treaties and the standards that have been set under those treaties. Because, you know, to go back to what you were saying a moment ago, how are these proposals being justified? Well, what I hear over and over again from the supporters of these police state measures is this information is useful. We can use it to catch some criminals. Now, maybe most of who we're actually catching is drug dealers rather than any actual terrorists, but if we surveil everybody, we catch some criminals. And there's no reference to limits on power. I mean, if the police break into every house and do house-to-house searches, they won't find illegal things in many houses, strangely enough. Does that mean that ex post facto they should just, like, start doing house-to-house searches, breaking down doors and ransacking everyone's home for something illegal, and then say, well, we broke down 100 doors and we found 3 criminals, or 97 criminals. So that proves that this program was necessary. It's very useful to break down doors. Well, nobody would argue that you won't find some criminals if you break into every house, but in our system, and under global norms of human rights and freedoms, that's not a sufficient justification. But if you ask police, is it useful to give you more powers, you know, to invade people's personal space, surveil them, collect information about them, what policemen won't say, the more the better.
We were talking yesterday, and I think that the statement that came across, because I feel right now like I've been punched in the stomach. Some of the stuff that I'm reading online, you know, and of course there's a lot of crap online, but the whole purpose of me using this as a forum to expose some of the surveillance that we are surfing on a large wave of statist policy that more or less is un-American. It goes against the Constitution, but it seems overpowering at this point. I wanted to talk to you just a tiny bit about this treaty with Canada and some of the foot traffic and travel using identity articles. Has any of the real ID stuff kind of changed, or have you noticed kind of a modicum of incrementalism go one way or the other when it comes to travel documents?
In terms of real ID, you know, we're still in this limbo place. You know, a great many states are politically, and their citizens, a great many people are on political, for political principle reasons, opposed to it. It's also clear that it would be prohibitively expensive. But the supporters of Real ID have left themselves no face-saving way to back out. Not that they want to back out anyway, but they haven't been able to negotiate any way to abandon Real ID without admitting that really this just wouldn't fly with the public. So we're in a strange limbo on Real ID. In terms of travel documents, we're also, you know, in a strange limbo. At the borders, we're seeing tremendous problems, even at the Canadian border, which on the one hand used to have the least restrictive controls, but on the other hand, that's the busiest border in the world. More trade crosses the U.S.-Canadian border than any other border in the world. So it's of paramount importance. And just the friction that's been put on trade relationships, the costs that it's imposed on both countries, have been enormous. You know, and Americans think, yeah, Canada, who cares? But Canada is our biggest trading partner. And the Canadians really are, they feel this much more acutely. I mean, the U.S. is more important to Canada than Canada is to the U.S. for all the obvious reasons. And so the good thing is that we're seeing increasing pushback from within Canada. And a lot of these debates get framed in the mainstream media as there's a dispute between the U.S. and Canada, or there's a dispute between the U.S. and Europe. But that's really, you know, a miscategorization. But what we're seeing is debate within Canada and within Europe about these issues. And it's the good and the bad side of this, that if the U.S. is going to, as it wants to, internationalize these control systems, it's going to have to find collaborators everywhere in the world. And that opens up the possibility for kinds of debate that have happened and I think are going to happen increasingly in the Canadian Parliament, in the European Parliament, and elsewhere in the world, where we haven't had that kind of debate in the U.S.
Let's talk about the fact that there's a consensus somewhere within the United States power structure, either between the White House and the agencies. It's this idea that this shall not be known or discussed or be subject for public input because it is an international matter. And this bent on public policy discussions and basically the American people being cut off from knowing these international policy matters, I think some of it gets tossed in the national security bucket, and I think that's where it goes, because it certainly seems that way when you are making press calls. You're not allowed to know this because that is a national security matter, which means where the Pentagon decides, here's what we decide is the news that you can have. And that's a separate problem that many people have been complaining about for many years. But I'm gonna hear it from you in terms of this discussion and framing this discussion and why it's such an elephant in the room.
Well, it's an elephant in the room because the U.S. doesn't really have to change its laws to allow this, because for the most part, we don't have much law that protects us in this way. The international human rights treaties have been ratified with reservations by the U.S. You can't invoke them in a U.S. court. You know, the Privacy Act doesn't apply to foreigners, and so forth and so on. But other countries may look at this differently, and, you know, the debates there are going to go on according to their own internal political processes and procedures. But I do think that there's the possibility of seeing some discussion. And when most of these agreements also, I should say, including, I suspect, the one likely to be announced in the next few days with Canada. From the U.S. side, these are executive agreements, which means the president negotiates them in secret and then signs them and doesn't present them to the Senate for actual ratification as a treaty.
Hmm.
And that means two things. It means, on the one hand, that we have no opportunity for congressional debate, since it's not going to Congress for ratification. It also means that these can only erode our rights and not protect them, since as long as they're not a treaty, you can't invoke this to challenge the government. So this has been a device that the U.S. has used diplomatically to evade, you know, public scrutiny. And certainly the whole critique of international treaty bodies and international negotiations and their lack of transparency is certainly one that, you know, lots of people in this country and around the world have been raising for a number of years in a number of contexts, whether that's, you know, the World Trade Organization and so forth and so on. And so it's a pattern that's been established that, you know, the U.S., you know, finds it convenient to go and negotiate with other countries and then come back. Having negotiated something like this in secret, they can then come back and say, or participated in a very closed international process, they can then come back and tell the U.S. public and even tell Congress, well, you don't have any choice in this matter because we've already signed an international agreement that commits us to this. Or, well, we've just agreed to follow international standards, but now the international standards say you have to do this, so you can't even argue about it. We're already committed to it. It creates dynamics that make it very hard for Congress to challenge it. But I should also say, Congress really doesn't have a stomach for this. You know, the sense in Congress, nobody is going to vote on the basis of Homeland Security policy. That the only, to stand up and challenge the government on this is only something that runs the risk of getting blamed for the next terrorist attack. So there's no upside, and there's this terribly risky downside. And in the few occasions when I can get people privately to talk to me in congressional staff, what they'll say is, well, I'm sympathetic, or the member is sympathetic, but of course we can't say anything public about this. So there's no champion for this cause in Congress at all yet.
Well, the operative word here is yet. It just seems so, I don't know, it's kind of defeated, to be honest. It's almost like we are reliant and kind of bound to the point where we really need WikiLeaks and we need these extra national people with conscience to kind of step up and be the voice for the Americans, because our government has cut us out of the process and we pay all the bills. And it's sad because, well, now that I'm looking at it, it's technical of a Mubarak or any other authoritarian regime which rules by state of emergency. You know, we make these executive decisions and you live with them, la-di-da.
You want to talk about what we can actually do. And,
yeah.
You know, it's really crucial that people be talking to people in Congress and letting them know not only you have opinions about these issues, that you don't want the TSA groping you, that you don't think it's anybody's business, you know, whether you asked for one bed or two in your hotel room, it's certainly not the government's business, that you don't want a permanent dossier that shows whether you asked for a kosher meal. You need to let Congress know that. But more than that, you need to let them know that this is a priority issue. And maybe it's not just about whether you're allowed to travel, but the big picture of the Homeland Security state, the Homeland Security industrial complex, the direction that the country is taking on fundamental freedoms is something that will have a substantial influence on your vote. Because if Congress does not believe this is an issue that is going to win or lose votes for them, they're not going to act.
That's true. That's true. The civil libertarian vote and the privacy vote has been kind of looked at like, not the redheaded stepchild, but I'll just say stepchild. And we get in there, but we've got like one person who's really the champion in a couple of instances. But we, since we don't have a lot of champions, our champions are not perfect. And, you know, so we have to span the divide and kind of work with what we have. You know, you've been around a long time and you attended the Securing Our Rights conference. One of the things that if I would have been there, I would have asked was, what are we doing to get a civil liberties offensive, because it appears that our strategy right now is to do everything on the defensive.
Well, I actually think this conference, which happened in San Francisco, although drew people from throughout the country last week, I think there was a fairly positive sense about it. There was a lot of discussion about some, you know, really awful directions that the country is taking. But it did bring together a lot of people who had not met each other, who had been working on, although it's a little hard to name what it is we're struggling against, been working on common problems, and we're beginning to talk to each other and network and make connections. And that was exciting. I think there was a sense of progress being made, and the strongest sense of progress being made, interestingly enough, came not from the people who were trying to work, as folks like me are, you know, primarily at the national level in Washington, but it came from people who are working in local community organizing, including in some of the communities that have been most impacted by this, such as immigrant communities, communities of poor people, communities of Arab Americans, Muslim Americans, South Asian Americans. Depth of the outrage in those communities, I think, is beginning to be felt. It's beginning to come together in coherent ways, and in ways that ultimately it will become harder and harder for Congress to ignore. And a lot of the discussion at the conference was, given that Washington isn't that responsive, but that a lot of people, you know, out in the boondocks, so to speak, or at the local level, however you want to put it, at the local level, you know, lots of communities are up in arms. And so what can we do, you know, without having control in Washington, what can we do at local level to limit, if not roll back, the impact of some of these measures? And certainly, you know, things that are going on, like the state-by-state resistance to real ID.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody anticipated that. You know, people thought there's a debate in Congress, you know, and the feds have spoken. But once the feds have spoken, you know, nobody imagined that states were going to say no. But they did. You know, and so where is the next point where we're going to see that kind of state-by-state, city-by-city resistance? And certainly one of the things we're seeing now that was a focus of discussion at the conference is resistance to the Secure Communities program, which involves essentially deputizing local police to perform a role as immigration police, as data gatherers for federal surveillance of us all. And there's very encouraging signs, not just in, you know, cities like San Francisco, but in other places around the country, of pushback. You know,
there's a fine line between this is law, this is policy, and then this is bullying. Mm-hmm. You know, there are untruths that are being foisted, and there's a lot being done under jurisdictional color of authority. And I think that was a main point that I was able to see, even from my participation from the net. What I wanted to add to this conversation was that these rights that they're stepping on are, in fact, core constitutional rights. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion. And the people who were not necessarily joiners at this one conference have been around for a while, too. These are the Christians who are getting pulled into rooms because maybe they're a little bit stiff on abortion rights. Or these are the kids who don't want their fingerprint taken up by, say, Newt Gingrich for an Amendment 2 situation where they want a gun, they want to register their gun. No, you can't have my fingerprint. Go screw yourself. And so these are the folks that are around, and they've been around a long, long time. You know, they're out there. They don't always come together with a resounding boom. I'm just getting to a point where I think that in terms of civil liberty, there's a lot of things where we're wearing out the goalie. And we need a civil liberties offensive in Washington. Do you see anything like that happening?
In Washington, unfortunately, I don't see that. I mean, I think if people are going to say, and this is, you know, no slur on the ACLU, they do great work and they've got more resources than anybody else in this field, but, you know, if people are going to say, you know, well, you know, I'm going to send some money to the ACLU, or I'm going to, you know, count on existing civil liberties organizations to stand up for my rights in Washington, you know, it's not happening. People are strapped. You know, contributions to all sorts of nonprofits are down. And, you know, this is partly why Congress thinks, well, you know, people ultimately are going to vote their pocketbook, their job, their mortgage, rather than, you know, voting on Homeland Security issues. But, you know, there are only fewer resources for people who are actually trying to send staff people to represent our views in Washington. So I think there's a very clear lesson that if people are getting aroused about this stuff, if you don't like what's happening, you need to speak up yourself. You need to communicate your views
yes.
directly to people in Congress and in Washington. You know, you can't be sitting back and waiting for somebody else to say the things that you want to be said. And the bottom line is, Congress members listen much more when they hear it from their constituents anyway than when they hear it from a lobbyist. They really do. You know, it's really frustrating when you call up and you know that somebody's just ticking a box and saying, you know, 17 people called today on this issue. But they tally up those ticks on those boxes, and they count them, and they report them to the member every day of what it is that people are calling about and which side they're on. And you need to make sure that you're getting counted there directly.
So we need to be as relentless as they are, as relentless as they are. That every time there's a new, you know, system, a new database, a new self-check system, E-Verify, ATS, I mean, because there's just going to be another one tomorrow. I mean, it's astonishingly redundant. And, you know, I can sit here and rattle off alphabet soup till we're both green in the face. But at the end of the day, you're right. Pick up the phone. Write a letter. Send an email. Tweet your friends. Tell your friends. I mean, if this is not going away. And when you travel this holiday season, please remember the Identity Project and hard work they're doing at papersplease.org. We've been talking to Edward Hasbrook. Ed, do you have any final recommendations for the audience here?
Get involved, learn about what's happening to you, and take action.
Thank you for joining us.
Happy holidays.
Wow, that is the perfect segue to our do-it-yourself government segment. Okay, so this week's do-it-yourself government is going to be a really neat one because it's an app. And I don't think that there's ever been an app that's specific to civic engagement, but this one is. It's called Do-It-Yourself Democracy, and you can buy it on iTunes, and it was developed at the Prometheus Institute. And what this cool app does is pretty interesting. I'm just going to read you a little note here I got from the developer. It says, Do-It-Yourself Democracy is an app which holds government accountable. It automatically locates users and connects them with their contacts at all three levels of government. For instance, you can send a photo, video, or text reports of police misconduct directly to your local police commissioner. Or reports of government waste directly to your designated state-level investigators. It's also providing information on the impact of citizens' constitutional rights, such as the rules governing vehicle searches and on-campus free speech. Overall, it is a tool for citizens to defend their freedoms, advance transparency, and pursue self-government. It's the perfect iPhone app to complain about cell phone surveillance, GPS location surveillance through your smartphone, and the fact that this is a spy tool that's used worldwide. So every time it irritates you that you're using a surveillance tool to communicate and download data and do the things you normally do and think you should do them without being watched by foreign governments or someone else who is a private contractor paid to do that because they can get the money from the government, I think you should send a little note to your elected representative. WikiLeaks so busted the smartphone industry and the telecom industry this week. It was last week, rather, that he just literally fried the smartphone industry for being a big, fat surveillance tool. So if you've got GPS on your phone, guess what? You've got surveillance in your back pocket. If you've got an iPhone or a smartphone, you've got surveillance in your pocket. And he also mentioned Gmail, which I'm on, but, you know, I've adjusted and made adjustments because I use it for press and for things that go out to the general public. So do-it-yourself democracy will be linked under the do-it-yourself government heading, along with a few other action alerts about S-1867 and a few other burgeoning things that could be coming down the pipeline today. There's some problems with that cybersecurity bill. It's a real nail biter. There's a whole bunch of things that are rolling out right now that you really need to be on top of as an individual because it's so going to affect you. Also, the holiday season. These are good things to get your friends and relatives so that they can become active and they can start responding in a unique way about whatever it is that their politics is. It's one of these things where you can equip them with tools and you don't have to actually engage in a discussion about actual politics. You can say, here, this is for civic engagement. It's really important that you go do this right now. This about wraps our show. I would like to encourage you to go to wakingup.orwell.info and join our mailing list. There's a way to do that now. So subscribe to wakinguporwell.info. That way you can get key information kind of pipelined in from beatthechip.org. You can also subscribe over there via mail list, or you can subscribe to beatthechip.org via RSS feed, which is always available. There's also the Godzilla Government blog, which is the overflow blog for things that are mass political. I mean, more political than I can kind of go and lose focus on Beat the Chip or Waking Up Orwell. And there are a few things. some of them have actually made it into the program, but I don't intend for that to be always the way it is. But just so you know, this blog, beatthechip.org, is kind of gone from the Real ID beat, which is, you know, something that's our main line. Anything that develops on Real ID is kind of something we continue to cover. But I want you to know that we're kind of shifting to whatever happens with transhumanist agendas that are kind of punched down our throat, or data surveillance, mostly data surveillance these days. Programs like DHS's Advise, ADVISE. God, there's so many. You can always rely on us to be the person who goes, hey, there's this obscure program that DHS is pushing that's going to watch everything you do. Ah! Anyways, happy holidays. Don't let it ruin your day. That's why we only do an occasional podcast every now and then these days. It's intense news, and we try to give you good advice where you are empowered to stay sane. And as long as you're kind of active and you keep moving, you're going to ensure your own soul's survival. I can't explain it. It's kind of magical like that, but the more that you do, the more control you have over what happens to your life. That's just the way it works. So that's kind of the ethos of what we try here at the program to kind of give you in terms of philosophy, which is why we always wrap the program by saying everyone has power, especially you. You give yourself power every time you get active and stay active. So enough preaching. I'm going to leave you with this uber preachy song by King of Soul, who has now gone on to the great beyond, Mr. James Brown. Enjoy it, and please, please, please have a happy holiday.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
licensed material is available for purchase on iTunes.